Osman there from Beirut, and thank you, Richard Medhurst, broadcast journalist from Vienna. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tatlay, the entire team is goodbye. Until next time.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم بما كنتم فيه تختلفون وهو الذي جعلكم خلائف الأرض ورفع بعضكم فوق بعض درجات
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: U.S. tech giant Google again targets Press TV, blocking the news outlet's YouTube accounts without prior notice. Witnesses describe shock and frustration during day two of the trial of a white former police officer over the murder of African-American George Floyd. Also in the headlines, Brazil registers a new daily record of nearly 3,800 COVID deaths, which account for about a quarter of Tuesday's fatalities worldwide. Stories. Welcome. Our top story: U.S. tech giant Google has once again blocked Press TV's YouTube accounts. Google did so late on Tuesday without prior notice to the Iranian news channel. Google has cited violations of community guidelines for its move. This is the seventh time YouTube has targeted Press TV. Last time was just in September. Last week, Facebook also permanently shut down Press TV's page. Iranian news outlet has repeatedly fallen victim to censorship on other social media platforms as well, including Twitter and Instagram. Press TV says the moves are hostile and will not prevent it from telling the truth about world developments. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says U.S. media corporations are against independent outlets like Press TV.
There are six American companies that together control 90% of the media in the United States. And these are large corporations, and they reflect the corporate agenda of the corporate class in the United States. And that is reflected in government policy, and policy is reflected in the media. So you have this corporate agenda that is, you know, imposed upon, and, you know, they will attack any independents like Press TV. They present a voice that is rarely heard in the United States. But they also have this pro-Israeli interest, and many of the owners of the media in the United States are Jewish and are Zionists.
The leaders of France, Germany, and Russia have discussed the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and reiterated support for the accord. The trio agreed to coordinated efforts so that Iran returns to full compliance with the deal. That's according to a French statement. The meeting held through video conference comes as Iran and the U.S. are at loggerheads over the nuclear deal.
The U.S. withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In response, Tehran has rolled back its commitments, but it says the measures are reversible after all sanctions are lifted. The U.S. says the sanctions will be lifted after Iran returns to full compliance. On Tuesday, Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif urged the United States to stop using its unlawful sanctions as leverage against Iran. And now people in Bahrain have held anti-government protests calling for the immediate release of all political prisoners. Protesters demanded the Al Khalifa regime protect prisoners against a pandemic. Demonstrators also said the regime must stop arresting people for their beliefs. The protests were held in various regions. A popular uprising began in Bahrain in early 2011, calling for equality and democracy. It was suppressed by the heavy-handed crackdown, that is, that led to a large number of deaths and thousands of arrests. The crackdown has continued as people have time and again held rallies pushing for their demands. A donors' conference organized by the EU and UN raises 5.3 billion euros for those impacted by the Syrian conflict. Aid agencies say it is not enough, as 24 million people are now in need of urgent support. Press TV's Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
More than 80 countries and international organizations took part in the fifth fundraising conference for Syria, coordinated from the European Commission in Brussels. Millions of Syrians displaced within their own country and millions more who fled face increasing hunger and poverty. Children have been very badly impacted during the 10-year conflict.
Tens of thousands of them have died. Almost half of all young people in Syria have lost an immediate family member or a close friend.
The US, UK and several EU nations have done all in their power to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Weapons supplied by the West to anti-government fighters were used to kill innocent civilians when these fighters joined Daesh. It's a point we raised with the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, during an online press conference.
Our Western nations not to blame to a large extent, or at least to some extent, for this catastrophe?
Borrell chose not to answer that question, so I asked if there's any justice in the EU donating 24 billion euro to Syria over the past 10 years, while donating 16 billion euro to Ukraine over a six-year period, perhaps because it has a border with the EU's adversary, Russia.
You cannot compare situation, a country destroyed by war and another country which is part of our neighborhood, where there is a strong support for performing reforms.
For its part, the UK told the event it is planning to apply more pressure on the Syrian government.
So this month I announced new sanctions on six individuals who are responsible for the repressing of the civilian population in Syria.
It's being suggested the apparent obsession the UK, US and EU have with sanctions is making a horrific situation even worse. Aid agency Oxfam says sanctions against the Syrian government are hampering efforts to provide humanitarian assistance within the country. Russia's Deputy Foreign Affairs Minister Sergei Vershinin told the conference that foreign interference in Syria must end in line with international law and sanctions should be lifted from the Syrian government. Brussels would be wise to cooperate with Moscow, experts suggest.
It is indeed the time at least to reconsider their relationships with Russia because, first of all, of deep Russian involvement in the Syrian conflict and because of the global impact of its involvement in the whole region.
Four out of five Syrian refugees are trying to survive in neighboring countries, not the EU, UK or US. The donors' conference raised 5.3 billion euro for 2021. Aid agencies are releasing statements saying it's simply not enough. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Witnesses have testified on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin. He's a former American white police officer who killed unarmed black man George Floyd in Minneapolis last year.
I identified myself right away because I noticed that he needed medical attention. It didn't take me long to realize that he had an altered level of consciousness, and in our training, that is when the first sign that somebody needs medical attention. So my attention moved from Mr. Floyd to how can I gain access to this patient and give him medical attention or direct the officers.
In her testimony, the firefighter said she was concerned about Floyd's health. She said his face looked puffy and swollen. Meanwhile, lawyers for Chauvin argued that he followed his police training and was not guilty of the charges. During the arrest of George Floyd last May, Chauvin knelt on his neck for about 9 minutes. There you go, there it is. Before he lost consciousness and died, the incident filmed by bystanders rocked the United States. It led to widespread protests against police mistreatment of African Americans. Child hunger in the U.S. has jumped by 50% during the COVID-19 pandemic, while a poor society safety net is getting most of the blame. Increasing consumer prices are putting food off the table for many low-income families. Ramin Mazahiri is in Chicago.
Data from the United States Census has found that child hunger has soared 50% since the pandemic hit 1 year ago. Some of the biggest increases have been recorded in the nation's wealthiest communities, where the unprecedented demand for food aid has overwhelmed local authorities. The federal government has been consumed by political infighting, as Congress only recently passed just the second major household stimulus, despite the prolonged economic devastation wrought by lockdowns.
The people in the U.S. just make so little money, and food is becoming so expensive that, you know, people can't afford food. And this has increased since the COVID crisis. And there's nothing in the U.S. Bill of Rights which says you are guaranteed a right to food. So the federal government really doesn't care.
The surge in hungry children is another reminder of the human toll caused by the infamously weak social safety net and the cutthroat capitalist culture of the world's richest country.
Meanwhile, you have farmers in Western states, since really the trade war with China started, that you've seen like mass quick slaughters of animals that were for meat because they couldn't make a profit because they can't ship to China. Since the pandemic started, you've had videos of like farmers having to light their potato crops on fire. So there's enough food in the U.S. It's just the system's not set up to get it to people.
The lockdowns have caused supply chain disruptions in food production, leading to increased food prices, which show no sign of lowering. While corporations can sometimes navigate disruptions, small grocers and corner stores, which are usually the only place to buy food in poor American neighborhoods, are forced to pass higher costs on to their customers, usually low-wage workers who are least able to afford price increases. In February, the UN's food price index rose for the 9th consecutive month, reaching a level not seen since 2014, a year that saw major food riots in multiple developing countries. It's not just food prices which have inflated out of the reach of many recently. Gasoline prices are at their highest point in 6 years, up over 40% in the past 12 months. Home prices are soaring faster than in almost a decade, up 11% over the past year. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Now, Brazil sets a new record in its coronavirus fatalities as the pandemic shows no signs of abating in that Latin American nation. Brazil registered nearly 3,800 daily COVID-19 deaths and almost 85,000 new infections. The government has come under fire for its handling of the crisis. Vaccination has been sluggish there, with fewer than 7% of people having received the jab. Brazil is the second worst hit country by the pandemic after the U.S. Fatalities in the U.S. have surpassed 550,000 and infections stand at over 30.3 million. The U.S. and more than a dozen of its allies have criticized a recent report by the World Health Organization investigators about the origins of COVID-19. A U.S.-led statement said the probe lacked the data and samples it needed, and the investigators did not have full access to them. The statement called for a transparent and independent analysis. The WHO chief made similar criticism. The team conducted its probe earlier this year in the Chinese city of Wuhan. That's where the coronavirus pandemic began. The probe concluded that the virus probably came to humans from animals, not from a lab. China says it has demonstrated its openness and that the issue must not be politicized. India has reported the highest number of COVID-19 cases in 5 months. Many feared a second wave is imminent and would put the whole nation at risk. As Munawar Zaman reports, the country has crossed the 12 million mark, making India the third highest or hardest hit country after the U.S. and Brazil.
The COVID-19 pandemic is once again worsening in India after a huge surge on Tuesday. The country reported more than 56,000 fresh cases and 270 deaths in the last 24 hours. This is the highest single-day spike since October last year. Authorities in state of Maharashtra have reimposed strict travel ban and nighttime curfews to prevent the further spread of the disease. Other states such as Punjab, Gujarat, Tamil Nadu, Haryana and Madhya Pradesh are the worst affected.
Health experts have warned about unchecked gatherings. They say the situation can be controlled if more people are vaccinated in a robust way and the COVID-19 protocols are strictly enforced and followed in spirit.
With a population of more than 1.3 billion, India's mammoth task of vaccinating its population is going on in full swing. At Rajiv Gandhi Hospital on the fringes of New Delhi, hundreds queue up to get their first shot every day. Coordinators say while many are now flocking in huge number, skepticism still remains for many about the possible side effects of the vaccine.
In India, basically, the vaccine hesitancy was there. And now, once the people are realizing that Covaxin or Covishield, both vaccines are really are not having any major side effect. So that has given confidence to the majority of the general population, and now they are really coming forward.
Since early October last year, India witnessed a consistent decline in the number of cases, raising hopes that the pandemic is retreating and over. Prime Minister Modi has called for decisive steps to halt the emergence of the second wave.
There may be little laxity in the behavior of the people. That is why the infections is being seen in majority of the people, particularly in Maharashtra.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism for the slow pace of the vaccination rollout. Health experts, however, say people are not taking the issue seriously and ignoring government calls for vaccination. Authorities have already expanded the vaccination program to reach a target of 300 million by July. However, fears have grown since last week about the second possible wave, which many say could be dangerous. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Now across the border in Pakistan, the prime minister has sacked the country's finance minister over his failure to control inflation. Imran Khan also decided to bring a major reshuffle to his cabinet as the government is struggling to revive the economy. Kamran Yusuf is in Islamabad.
Across the board, unka ek spectrum hai.
This is the third finance minister appointed by Prime Minister Imran Khan in the last 2.5 years. Hamad Azhar, the Minister for Industries, has been appointed as the new finance minister after incumbent Hafiz Sheikh was sacked by the Prime Minister. Sheikh, who has a vast experience of working with international financial institutions and even previously served as finance minister, has been blamed for failing to control the inflation.
Prime Minister Imran Khan has reviewed the government's 2.5 years' performance, and the government is looking to change its economic strategy. That is why the Prime Minister is now bringing a new economic team.
Pakistan's economy has been struggling since Prime Minister Khan took charge in August 2018. Last year, the country reported a negative economic growth, while the forecast for the current fiscal year does not look promising either. The sluggish economic growth has led to the unprecedented inflation, causing problems for the common man.
The inflation is really making our life difficult. There is a price hike in everything. Sacking the finance minister will not bring relief to the people. The government needs to change its policies.
Sir, relief, jo hai na, sir. Government needs to take steps to lower the prices of daily use items. This is the only demand of common people.
The sacked finance minister could not win the Senate election earlier this month, when his own party lawmakers voted against him. Opposition parties, which are seeking the ouster of Prime Minister Khan, describe as their victory the removal of the finance minister.
We have been repeatedly told that inflation is being brought under control, the economy is growing, and all economic indicators are positive. But now the finance minister has been sacked for failing to control the inflation. This is our vindication.
Imran Khan has promised to bring economic and other reforms, but observers believe that his government has so far failed to live up to the expectations.
With growing public and opposition pressure, Prime Minister Khan is bringing a new economic team to control the inflation and revive the economy. He has also decided to reshuffle his cabinet, but it remains to be seen if all these changes will improve the government's performance. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Well, that's about it for me. Many thanks for staying tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Spring can be the start of a good phase in life. This is indeed what we ask God in the moment of turning of the year. We pray to God to change our state to the best state, asking for development, and the best state is the sign of growth. The one who doesn't seek improvement and doesn't make any effort for it is like swamp. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says, "Be either a scholar or in the state of learning, and do not spend your time in idleness and revelry." For sure, asking, praying for development is good, but it is not enough. Praying is very important as it connects us with the source of power, but human being needs movement to attain his goals. The life of every person is the mirror of his outlook, inclinations, and decisions. Human being plays an effective role in shaping his life. Positive outlook will bring about positive changes, and determination of a goal will reduce waste of time. In view of this, Islam has put high emphasis on self-building and inward development. Islam teaches us to have an inward trip and evaluate our deeds and even intentions every day. Self-reckoning makes us familiar with our flaws in character. For instance, self-reckoning may show us that we are jealous of others' successes. This way we can find the root cause of jealousy and cure it. This will help us move toward change. Basically, discovery of defects and shortcomings can prepare the ground for removal of them. This measure is like the spring which beautifies and refreshes everything. Another way for better living is to create moderation in life. Shunning extravagant entertainments will put life in a correct route. Human being like spring should pass through hardships and pains to attain good results. Unfortunately, modern devices and media have made mankind busy to the extent that he has lost himself. This is most evident in the social media and cyberspace. internet and social networks such as Telegram, Instagram, Facebook, etc. have created visual attractions for most users. These attractions can be called visual magic as they fascinate their users in an uncontrollable manner. Excessive usage of internet and social media has gravely affected family life and social relations. Family members are indulged in the social media in a way that they neglect each other, though they live apparently together. Sociologists maintain that cyberspace has highly reduced audio, visual, and verbal contact between family members and aggravated stresses and anxieties. Therefore, modern man is in dire need of time management for better living. Time management has to be carried out as a family rule. In other words, parents and children should consider it as a duty to limit their browsing in the cyberspace and spend their specified time with family members. Of course, time management for the best usage of cyberspace requires government's attention to guide adolescents and children in the right direction. Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "A faithful divides his day and night in three parts. He spends one part for supplication to God, spends the second part for making a living, and the third part for halal pleasure. So it doesn't behoove a wise man to move except in three things: attaining livelihood, moving in the way of hereafter, and pleasure that is not forbidden." Imam Ali, peace upon him, in this wise saying, has in fact outlined the program for a better life. In view of this, one part of the routine life is spent in communion with God, one part for making money, and the last part for religiously permitted pleasures and entertainment. This way, the individual will not make effort to stand on his own feet. This division is quite wise and logical. One of the ways of better living is acquisition of knowledge and discovering hidden talents. Acquisition of knowledge and striving in this way is considered as worship if it is done for the sake of God, with the aim of solving people's problems and rendering service to them. The great wise man Luqman said to his son, "Dear son, in your days and nights and hours, specify a time for acquisition of knowledge, because no misery in life is similar to the misery of abandoning knowledge." Dear listeners, basically, human beings' perfection passes through the course of knowledge, ethics, and labor. In this important course, it is very important to find and bring up talents so that they cause flourishing of society in various fields. Just like the nature demonstrates freshness by flowers, plants, gushing of fountains, and singing of birds, thriving of talents will refresh a society and will prevent it from frustration, wearing away, and backwardness. But the absolute and ultimate flourishing, growth, and perfection of human community will take place with the coming of the awaited Redeemer of mankind, Imam Mahdi. May God hasten his reappearance.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name is Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. Now we kick things off here because positive vaccine sentiment in Britain, well, it's gone up by more than 90% since the start of the year. But as Saeed Poreza reports, a combination of conspiracy theories, the lack of trust in the government, and the healthcare system has led certain British communities to think twice about taking the jab.
The Beit Ul Futuh Mosque in London, one of the largest in Western Europe, hosting a pop-up vaccine clinic to boost inoculation rates and overcome vaccine hesitancy amid the many myths that have been created around the pandemic.
NHS approached us and they said with the idea of a pop-up clinic, a vaccination clinic, and you know we welcomed it. Our community has had an abnormally high number of people that have suffered from the virus.
We dispel the myths about microchips and blood clots and answer their queries. Some are really concerned about their fertility.
British scientists say there is a historical trend of lower vaccine uptake in areas with a higher proportion of ethnic minority groups in England.
A recent study found that a high percentage of people from Pakistani or Bangladeshi origins said they were unlikely to be vaccinated. Among black Britons, the figure stands at more than 40%, the highest of all ethnic groups in this country, meaning that some of the most vulnerable people are the least likely to get the jab.
And that's a concern for the British government, which plans to inoculate every adult in the country with the first dose of the vaccine by the end of summer. Online, videos distorting people's understanding of the virus and the vaccines abound. This one, that claims silver solution kills the virus, was proved false by a news channel. Conspiracy theories have deepened public distrust in medical science.
Well, I think there's been some indication amongst South Asians for the Indian community that there might be some element of beef in the vaccine, that it might be unsafe. Particularly, there's been these questions of whether there's any pork content, porcine content, pig content to the vaccine, which there is not, but those rumours have been going amongst the Pakistani community in particular, which is large in our country, and they are false accusations.
Among some black Britons, a sense of unease. They don't trust the government. Some fear there might be different vaccines for black and white people. This week, a video featuring high-profile black figures urging black Britons to take the vaccine.
But we're asking you to trust the facts about the vaccine from our own professors, scientists, and doctors.
Vaccine hesitancy also extends to ultra-Orthodox Jewish communities, mostly over fears it might contain pork, or from the perspective of this controversial rabbi, popular on YouTube, it might alter people's sexual orientation. Conspiracy theorists exploit a lack of trust in the government and a health system that to some ethnic minorities appears to favor white people and the more affluent. The British government's challenge now is to build trust in the vaccines proven to save lives. Saeed Poreza, London.
Well, Dr. Bob Gill, who's the producer of the great NHS Heist, and of course, a practicing family GP. Now, why has the take-up been so low, Dr. Gill? I mean, we've heard some of the reasons here, but how are you finding it from your perspective?
Well, generally, my patients are very well. The vaccine, if we hear there's any hesitation, amongst high-risk groups, then it will take the time to speak to individual patients and reassure them that the vaccine is safe. All my staff who are eligible have had the vaccine. I have had the vaccine, my wife has the vaccine, and often when they have these personal accounts and reassurance from a trusted health professional, that often helps get over the head.
Now, one of the major issues here is the misinformation being promoted online. How can that be combated?
It's very difficult. You know, it doesn't take long for lies to spread very widely, and often there may even be an element grain of truth, but things get amplified out of proportion, and they pick up on individuals' mistrust of government, as your report very clearly outlined. And you know, we do know that society is not equal. There is discrimination out there in society, particularly, you know, with the hostile environment and how poor immigrant populations have been treated in recent years. So that trust has been eroded by government policy. But when it comes to healthcare, in particular, the uptake in the vaccination program, we have to undo some of that damage, which has been, you know, well-founded in terms of trust in government.
Now, we're hearing several reports that there are different European countries that are seriously considering implementing the vaccine passports for those who are thinking of international travel, of holidays, and so on. Do moves like this help or hinder the pro-vaccine message?
I think, in a way, governments may be using this as a stick in terms of limiting people's freedom to travel. But, you know, it's a double-edged sword. If you introduce some sort of passport system for vaccination, well, that may also indicate the thin edge of the wedge. You may start to introduce other health information which people would rather be kept private. And there is that argument that this might lead to creeping expansion of the amount of information we have to provide to travel. So I'm reluctant to support the passport idea just because we don't know where this might end up. But I think we need to use every positive means to encourage people to take up the vaccine.
Dr. Bob Gill, thank you, as always. Now, we stay here in the United Kingdom, where we begin with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who joined more than 20 other world leaders in calling for a new global treaty to help the world prepare for any future pandemics. In a joint letter published today in newspapers around the world, the leaders argued that the COVID-19 crisis had posed the greatest challenge for the global community since the late 1940s. In the letter, the leaders expressed hope that any future treaty would provide a more robust international health architecture that provides better protection for future generations. The document was signed by 24 signatories, including the head of the World Health Organization, in addition to leaders from across Europe, Asia, and Africa. The United Nations is urging international donors to pledge up to $10 billion to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Syria, adding that the need for humanitarian support in the country has never been greater. The appeal comes on the same day as Tuesday's Brussels Conference on Syria, an annual event co-hosted by the UN and the European Union. Ahead of the event, UN aid chief Mark Lowcock stated that plummeting living conditions, economic decline, and COVID-19 have resulted in more hunger, malnutrition, and disease. Earlier this month, Syria marked its grim 10-year anniversary of the war. The foreign-backed conflict in Syria, which flared up in 2011, has so far claimed the lives of 500,000 people and has left millions more displaced.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Robert Inlakesh, we know that Riyadh is very keen to launder its reputation We heard about sports washing, but this time using the environment in what some are calling a little bit of greenwashing. Tell me more.
Well, this is an interesting story. Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, is pledging that 10 billion trees will be planted in Saudi Arabia in a bid to tackle climate change. And on top of that as well, this factors into the 2030 plan that they put forth, which of course is supposed to gear Saudi Arabia to essentially move away from its dependency upon oil purely. But from the kingdom, what we have seen is that in an attempt to try and distract people, and specifically its critics, they have attempted to, like you said, sports wash and use things like this, now an environmental cause, in order to try and take attention away from the real issues inside of their kingdom. Namely, in this case, if we're talking about climate change, it's interesting that they're currently bombarding Yemen, and the airstrikes have only gone up since the U.S. Biden administration has came into power. That's not going to be good for the environment, yet we're seeing that these pieces are distributed. Even this piece that we pulled up was on the Independent. They're putting it out in, of course, a way which makes Saudi Arabia look good. When people see these headlines, people think that Saudi Arabia is moving towards progress, but that is not what we're seeing with Saudi Arabia. In fact, we're seeing that things like beheadings are on the rise, and of course, its bombardment and genocide, as it's been termed, inside of Yemen is only escalating.
Now, with some of the comments you mentioned there, is that being reflected online, Rob?
Well, the first comment we've got here, and an immediate reaction to this when the story came out, in fact, is from a Twitter user who says, make sure to name the forest Jamal Khashoggi. This guy is a criminal and dictator with innocent blood on his hands. We've got another one here as well who says, how does someone acquire 10 billion trees? More like 10 billion lies.
Right, we leave that there. And we move to another story where you touch very briefly upon perhaps the impact of the Biden administration here in not stopping the situation in Yemen. Syria's now come up. What is Mr. Blinken, the new Secretary of State, saying?
Well, the Secretary of State hosted a meeting, a virtual meeting in the United Nations Security Council yesterday, and he sort of emerged as a heroic figure from it, at least if you were to read the Western press, that's how it's being portrayed, as he's calling for the opening of more humanitarian aid corridors and the upping of aid into Syria. You know, it just so happens that the humanitarian king, Antony Blinken, is calling for the aid corridors, which lead directly into northeastern Syria, to be opened most urgently. And that's where the United States just so happens to have a few hundred of its forces, and of course, its allies, the Kurdish SDF, operating and holds the country. And of course, it is the United States, and Antony Blinken was part of this in the Obama administration, that helped start this war, backing Al-Qaeda-linked groups. And of course, in this meeting as well, we saw a lot of attention on northwestern Syria, which is controlled by a group, primarily this group called Hayat Tahrir al-Sham. And they are an offshoot, essentially the name has just changed, of Shabat al-Nusra, which is Al-Qaeda in Syria, essentially. Whilst this was ongoing and we saw a lot of talk about the humanitarian situation in Syria, we saw relatively no talk whatsoever about the sanctions regime, that's the CSAR Act. They said over the past year, the humanitarian situation has grown in extremely dire. It's got a lot worse. But it was last year, in fact, in June, when the CSAR Act was first put into action. And so it's only natural that this has happened in the country. And yet we're not hearing anything. In fact, it was only the Syrian and Russian representatives in the Security Council that even mentioned the sanctions.
Indeed, you wouldn't be at all suggesting that the two things are linked, would you, Robert? I mean, perish the thought. Quick trawl through social media, please.
The first reaction we have here states that the United States waged a decade-long proxy war against Syria, is occupying large swathes of its territory, stealing its oil, wheat supplies, and imposing sanctions so severe millions of Syrians are going hungry. And this piece of garbage has the goal to talk about humanitarian aid. It's depraved. We've got another one here as well, another strong response from Todd, who says, when Syria refused to have the pipeline bisect their nation, the United States organized and funded terrorists and imposed sanctions. Humanitarian aid does not come with strings nor conditions. Humanitarians do not impose complicity with siege warfare.
All right, strong words to leave it on. Robert Imakesh, thank you. Now, pious Muslim women across Europe are finding life more difficult amid growing Islamophobia. Switzerland became the most recent country to ban the niqab on the continent, forcing Muslim women to give up a key aspect of their faith by force. Now, what impact does this state-backed anti-Islam law have on women's lives? Well, Robert Carter followed up the story and filed this report.
The European-wide Islamophobia epidemic has shown little sign of curbing as more countries join the criticized burqa ban. Swiss Muslims have been the latest to feel the effects of hate after a referendum passed banning all face coverings in public spaces.
Being free is to be able to show our face, respect women's dignity, have our own identity, and therefore I do not understand the discourse of people who want to imprison women behind this veil.
Following the ban, I reached out to Zainab, a German national who travels regularly to Switzerland, and asked how the ban has impacted her.
This ban makes me really sad and angry because it's the second article here in the federal constitution against the Islam. I think we have to understand that it's not against the niqab or against the minaret. It's against the global Islam. It's just an Islamophobia act. And I think they are not finished. They are looking for the next step.
The ban isn't the first anti-Islam move adopted by the Swiss, as I found out after speaking to the Islamic Central Council of Switzerland.
I just can confirm you. I mean, Swiss chocolate is great. Even we Muslims, we love it. And Toblerone is now even halal, so it's a great thing, yeah? In terms of Islamophobia, this is less great, yes, indeed. Actually, we are indeed suffering since 2009, when this first referendum came up against the minarets, which has been indeed banned with 57.3% of the Swiss population voting yes for this ban. We are constantly, during the last 10 years as a community, have been attacked by the media, have been the target of certain stereotypes.
Local campaigners and activists have vowed to fight back against the ban. However, the global Muslim attention fixed elsewhere, the defenders of Islam in Switzerland have yet to receive the support they deserve. The reasons behind enforcing the ban vary from country to country, with some claiming it's a security threat, while others simply say that it contradicts Western ideals. Now, whatever the excuse, the traumatizing effect that the ban has on devout Muslim women has been made clear by those who suffer from its enforcement. Robert Carter, London.
France's foreign minister has cranked up further pressure on Lebanese leaders to form a working government, urging them in personal phone calls for an immediate halt to what he called deliberate obstruction. Earlier in the week, Jean-Yves Le Drian called Lebanese President Michel Aoun, Acting Prime Minister Saad Hariri, and Parliamentary Speaker Nabi Berri, and called for an end to the 7 months of political deadlock that's driven the country toward collapse. The latest rounds of talks between Aoun and Hariri collapsed last week. Disagreements over the shape and size of a new cabinet continue to block any progress. Lebanon is currently facing its worst economic crisis in modern history, a situation exacerbated by pandemic restrictions and last year's explosion at Beirut's port. It's the event that reignited the Black Lives Matter movement last summer in the U.S. and across the globe. Derek Chauvin, the white police officer who knelt on the body of African-American George Floyd, is finally in the docks with the eyes of the world on his every move, on his every statement. Richard Sudan's been closely following this one online. It's disturbing already, Richard.
And it's disturbing many people around the world who are keeping an eye on proceedings, having seen the event take place in May of last year. Now, there's been massive protests taking place outside the courthouse where proceedings are happening. And on the second day of the trial of Derek Chauvin, we've seen some very emotional and graphic testimony from witnesses that have been called to the stand. Now, we've heard one testimony from one witness named Donald Williams, who talked about the life draining away from George Floyd's eyes, the life visibly draining away from his face as Derek Chauvin knelt on his neck for almost 9 minutes. And he talked about the fact that George Floyd was quite clearly not resisting arrest. And this witness flatly referred to the actions of Derek Chauvin as murder, which of course chimes and resonates with how most people around the world really saw this event transpire. We saw another witness talk about the fact that viewing the footage of the incident taking place in real time, that Derek Chauvin knelt on the neck of George Floyd for so long that she actually thought the video footage had actually frozen. The scenes were that serious. And actually, one of the things which is really catching people's attention and which people are incredulous about is the fact that the defense is arguing that Derek Chauvin used reasonable force and was following police protocol and procedures. Vast, you know, millions of people around the world really don't view it this way, Amina. Derek Chauvin is facing two counts of murder, one count of manslaughter, and people are already skeptical about whether or not they'll see a conviction. And of course, the actual reality in the United States, I'm afraid for many people, is that even if Derek Chauvin goes to prison, for there to be a real precedent set which would actually see systemic change in the United States, there are numbers and there are many, many police officers, critics would say, that simply need to be jailed for the killing of black people while they wear police uniforms, Amina. So the whole world is watching this trial, and we've seen very emotional testimonies indeed.
Social media for us. Can you choose your favorite two tweets on this topic for me, Richard?
Let's go first to Bishop Talbot Swan, who says, which one of you who are swearing that Derek Chauvin's actions had nothing to do with George Floyd's death are willing to lay handcuffed on the ground and allow a grown man to kneel on your neck with his full weight for 9 minutes to demonstrate how harmless that is? I'll wait. And we have a reaction also from Daniel, who says, if they don't do the right thing in the Derek Chauvin trial, it seems reasonable to expect that major response activities will take place. George Floyd was absolutely intentionally murdered. Floyd mattered and still does, and thousands upon thousands of other victims do too.
All right, we'll move on to another story, controversial for different reasons, Richard.
Indeed. So Ghislaine Maxwell, the confidant, partner, and some would say collaborator with Jeffrey Epstein, is facing sex trafficking charges. Now, of course, Jeffrey Epstein was accused of running perhaps most the wide-reaching and elaborate abuse ring possibly in history, many people are saying. And of course, Ghislaine Maxwell was a key figure in that. Now, she's facing charges. We'll see where this goes. Of course, Epstein actually died in New York Correctional Facility in the summer of 2019. The official reason was, of course, suicide, but many people actually say that he was murdered in order to prevent him testifying and releasing information on a lot of people. And some people would say Prince Andrew is one of the people that potentially would have had the lid lifted on his activities. And so, of course, this trial and these charges are about Ghislaine Maxwell, but really this is about the number of people that were potentially implicated in this abuse ring ran by Jeffrey Epstein. And actually, I mean, some people say that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell were Israeli spies. That's what a lot of people online are certainly saying. So, you know, this kind of move is welcome, if you like, but I'm afraid for a lot of people, the fact that Jeffrey Epstein will never take the stand will probably, some might say, mean that many other people potentially implicated in this massive, massive crime will never face full accountability for their actions. Of course, Prince Andrew was famously pictured with Virginia Giuffre, who was allegedly trafficked, with Ghislaine Maxwell literally in the picture. And of course, the famous interview took place with Prince Andrew, where he denied virtually all of the questions that were put to him.
Despite some of that photographic evidence, we have time for just one tweet, Richard.
So let's go to Anthony online, who says, "G'day, Maxwell, officially charged with sex trafficking of minors. Will Trump send her another message wishing her well in court? And will Prince Andrew's inability to sweat finally be cured? Hashtag Trump."
Wow, it may well be that miracle. Richard Sedan, thank you. And thank you so much for being with us for this edition of The Bulletin. Please stay there until next time.
In the limelight.
1 year after the COVID-19 pandemic began, U.S. billionaires have made out like gangbusters at the expense of workers, says Chuck Collins, author, in an article published under the heading 10